Hello, and welcome to episode 94 of SMARTS, which, as you know, stands for Scott Magically Artistically Rendered Two Smarties. Do you get that one?
I get it.
Okay, I got another one. Switch makers add radness to society.
Ooh.
Yes, I had to use both of them this week because it has been a very action-packed week, and, well, it deserved two acronyms, not just one.
I agree.
Yes. So I am one of your hosts, Giulia Guglia of internet fame, dash podcaster. And with me is Trevor, a.k.a. Rutger Q podcaster, a.k.a. hand-waving extraordinaire, who still needs a couple pointers here and there about the audio medium versus the visual format, as he flashes me a thumbs up. Okay. How about some news?
Okay.
Great. Take it away.
All right. So this week, a little bit of news. So we got our first photos of the cast and some locales from Thor Ragnarok, from courtesy of Entertainment Weekly. So Thor himself has a new look. He's got some new armor. No sign of his hammer yet. And he's got a new shorter haircut.
Yep.
And we got the first photos of Tessa Thompson as Valkyrie and Cate Blanchett as Hela and Jeff Goldblum as the... I forget whether it's Games Master or Grandmaster. I want to say it's Grandmaster.
I thought it was Games Master, but
Games
I could
Master?
Be wrong.
Okay, whatever.
Because it reminded me of the weird colors and everything that was done to Jeff Goldblum via makeup. Reminded me a lot of The Hunger Games, and that was the Games Master.
That's where I'm getting it from. So what do you think? And we also, one of the photos also showed Mark Ruffalo as Bruce Banner in there, giving Thor a big hug.
cool.
And we got a bit more... hints about the story, how it seems like through his incompetence, but given the fact that Loki, as of the end of Thor the Dark World, is impersonating Odin, is perhaps not quite up to the task, Hela manages to get free from her imprisonment within Asgard and promptly attacks, and Thor is banished or teleported or something to this distant world of Sakaar, which is ruled by Jeff Goldblum's character. And there he's pitted gladiator style against other inhabitants in an arena, and it's there that he meets the Hulk. Presumably the Hulk, when he flew away in the Quinjet at the end of Age of Ultron, flew all the way to the other side of the galaxy. There's a bit of a story there that I imagine they'll fill in,
yeah.
And he's got to, you know, win there, and then presumably...
Most importantly, what happened to the Quinjet?
Then presumably he makes his way back to Earth where...
They recover the Quinjet?
Well, I think you're placing undue importance on the Quinjet. So what do you think of these photos?
I really like the photos. I didn't recognize... Tessa Thompson looks amazing. I legit did not recognize Cate Blanchett. What they did to her look, but also her stance and just how she posed for the character photos looked incredibly fearsome and just awesome. So evil. I didn't recognize her. I forgot that she was cast in this role. And so when I just saw the pictures without the names until you told me who it was, I couldn't have figured it out.
And Carl Urban is in this movie too, is like the little bad, but we haven't seen him yet.
Oh,
in any of the
that's
photos.
Gonna be fun.
Maybe he's gonna be mostly CG and that's why we haven't seen him.
Oh,
I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah, I agree. It looks really good. Apparently they're going for, I don't know, the Thor movies have always most of the humor comes from fish out of water stuff.
Yeah.
But I think so. They've always had that lighter touch. But I've been seeing from the set reports and stuff, and the article in Entertainment Weekly, all the actors are sort of saying, "Are we supposed to be having this much fun in a movie called Ragnarok?" Like, so I don't know. It really seems like it's going to be a fun movie.
Nice.
It's not going to be too dark and depressing with the death of the gods and all this other stuff. I mean, maybe that stuff will be in there. Maybe it's just a name. I don't know. But we'll see. It definitely seems like they're having fun. I mean, all I've seen from the director so far are those Team Thor shorts that he did for the other movies. And those are obviously
so good.
Those are obviously funny, but I don't know if they're necessarily any indication of the tone the movie itself is going to take.
We need to hire a servant, yes.
So also this week, we got a new trailer for the Wonder Woman movie just a couple of days ago.
So good.
Billed as an origin trailer.
So good.
So we saw quite a bit more of Themyscira.
Yeah.
Not really a lot more of the villains. A lot of the stuff. I don't know. I think
I'm not super clear on who the villains are.
First trailer focused more on action, and there was more of Steve Trevor in there, and more of Etta Candy. This one was definitely more focused on Themyscira.
Yeah.
And hence why it was billed as an origin trailer. So we saw more of Hippolyta. We saw more of her training.
We saw a young Diana of Themyscira come into her own.
And there was a line from Hippolyta in voiceover saying, you know, she must never find out the truth about her origins or something, which people are unsure what that means, because it could mean that she was told she was just a regular Amazon and they don't want her to find out she was made from clay. Or it could be going back to the Azzarello thing where she was told she was made from clay, but the dark secret is that her mother actually had an affair with Zeus, which I don't know. I mean, they've gotten away from that now in the comics. Like, they've retconned that as being part of the whole false Themyscira thing that's going on. So her classic origin is back. But this movie would have been written and shot in that weird interregnum period where that was the official origin. So part of me wonders if the Zeus, daughter of Zeus thing might have squeaked in.
Right.
Because that's when the movie was being made.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And if so, it'll go down as a weird quirk of history.
She's clearly immortal because, or at least, you know, by...
Well,
in most depictions, she's
ageless. But she has mystical origins. Either she's a demigod or she was. You know,
there have been some representations that she's only ageless when she is on Themyscira. Like the little girls are born, they grow, but they stop aging after a certain age, like 25 or so, and they just stay immortal forever.
In some versions, all the Amazons are ageless all the time. In other versions, they're only ageless when they're on Themyscira.
Exactly.
And in other versions, they age on Themyscira also, which is the way it was in the Azzarello run, where they had to constantly go out and find men to repopulate
them,
which was part of the whole controversy over that run about the methods in which they did so. But Diana has always been a special case. I think in pretty much every version, she does not age, whether that's unique to her or something that she shares with the other Amazons,
mm-hmm.
because of her special origins. Either mm-hmm. she's a demigod and gods don't age, or because she was made from clay, she's not human, and so she doesn't age the same way. That's almost always been the case. So you can't really infer anything from that. But it looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
This trailer didn't have a lot of the humor in there, and we also don't really know
it
much about it.
It had some though.
They always have
all three of the
trailers we've seen so far have ended with a little humorous tag with Etta Candy in there. So I think that's where most of the humor is going to be coming from.
She's walking around with a shield. That doesn't go with that outfit, no.
And so we still don't know much about the villains. I mean, I've read a little bit. It's been mentioned here and there in interviews, and people have sussed things out from, like, you know, action figures that have been revealed at toy fairs and stuff like that. So I think I've got a pretty good idea who the villains are going to be, and it's kind of what you would expect. But I don't necessarily need to go into all that, because if the trailers aren't making it obvious, then it's probably not supposed to be obvious. So I won't go into all that. But yeah, I think it looks really good. I think that the line we just talked about, the truth about her origins, has got some of the fans a little unsure about which way they're going to go with that, because the whole Daughter of Zeus thing was very controversial, as we've talked about before. But if that ends up in there, but it's done well, then I'm not sure I would have that much of a problem with it. But part of me does hope that this is the first time she's been on the big screen in her own movie. Part of me wants to see the classic origin, especially if this is going to be a version that's going to be sticking around through all these other movies. It would be weird if she had this weird, aberrant origin that's not the way it's ever been before, you know?
Right.
But I think it looks really good. So in TV news...
Mm-hmm.
An actor whose name you probably don't know, but you've seen in several things, David Dastmalchian. Was recently in Gotham as the weird coroner guy that was obsessed with bringing Jerome back. Before that, he was in Ant-Man.
Oh, him. Yes. And Ant-Man, I remember.
He is going to be appearing on The Flash as Abracadabra.
Oh,
one of the few remaining major rogues that they haven't gotten to yet.
Oh, man. That's going to be awesome.
I think we said
going... Is he going to be a time traveler then?
Because
that's who Abracadabra, he's from the super distant
future. I think that they
future.
Said that, and I think that the information seems to indicate that given that he's from the future, Barry's obsessed with finding out what he knows about what's going to happen.
Right.
Right, with Savitar and everything. So he's going to see him as much as a source of information as someone that he needs to defeat, which will be an interesting, you know...
That will be interesting.
...line to try to walk. I think I said at the beginning of the season that Mirror Master and Abracadabra are like the two... And then you could say maybe the top also, and they got her in there too. They made he or her.
Mm-hmm.
But they were like the two biggest rogues left that they hadn't done yet. And now they've got them. And there's, you know, a few minor ones here and there, but they're the two biggest ones they haven't done yet. So they've got them in there. So, so it's good. And he always seems like he's got an interesting look about him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know if they're going to go full, you know,
full
handlebar
yes.
mustache.
Well, that's not a handlebar, my friend. That's
vaudevillian.
That's the pencil thin.
Yeah,
mustache.
But he's got sort of a vaudevillian magician
yes,
style to him,
definitely.
Which juxtaposed with the fact that he's actually from the far,
future,
far future, and all the things that he's
Well, you know, I mean, styles come around in cycles, you know, with the leg warmers made a brief comeback, you know. Chirp, chirp. They have not made a comeback. I'm just saying things go in styles. Everybody knows that in like 20 or 30 year cycles, things that used to be in fashion. Anyway.
That's true. That's true.
Throw me a rope and pull me out of this hole I dug myself into.
So in other casting news, we know that Sonequa Martin-Green is going to be the main character in Star Trek Discovery.
Yep.
But we also knew that she was going to be playing, I think it's a lieutenant commander or commander, but I think lieutenant commander, and not the captain of the eponymous.
Is she going to be the first officer?
I think she's the science officer. I'm not sure. Oh. If she was a first officer, she would probably be a full commander, and I thought she read she was a lieutenant commander.
Okay.
But then again, her nickname is number one, right?
So maybe she's the second in command. Anyway. She's sort of the Spock on the ship.
I guess it's, well.
The Spock rank on the ship.
Well, yeah, in the sense that Spock was second in command, but not in the sense that, you know.
It was the hierarchy was Captain Kirk and then Mr. Spock.
The original show was a little weird in that the second in command also had a specific role.
Yes.
Like Spock was the science officer, but he was also the second in command. Whereas on, say, Next Gen, Riker was just the second in command. Like he didn't have any other role. He was command track, not science track.
Okay.
And he was just there to be the second in command.
Okay.
Similarly, on Voyager, Chakotay was the second in command, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, I haven't seen those shows, so this is information I didn't have.
Given that this takes place before the original series, she could well be like Spock, playing some specific role on the ship in addition to being the second in command.
Yes.
But I'm just more used to the later stuff where the second in command was just there. Because being the first officer on a huge ship like this is job enough. You wouldn't think you'd want that duty split between that and being, say, the science officer.
Right.
To me, that doesn't make much sense. Anyway. We're getting off track. So we know that she's not going to be the captain of the ship, but we didn't know who was going to be playing the captain.
Okay.
Now we do. So Jason Isaacs, who a lot of people know, I don't know, a lot of people our age probably know as the, what was the name? Was it Lucius Malfoy? Who was the father in the Harry Potter movies? Not the little Malfoy, not Tom Felton.
Lucius Malfoy. Not so Draco.
So he played Lucius Malfoy in the Harry Potter movies.
That's awesome.
He's been in a lot of other stuff. He's done quite a bit of voiceover.
He was in The Patriot. He was the main bad guy in The Patriot.
I'll take your word for that.
It was so good. They almost didn't cast him. They almost didn't cast him as Draco Malfoy. Draco Malfoy's dad, because they saw him in The Patriot before this, and he walked into the audition, and they wanted to be assured that cold stare he could do, but they wanted some depth and three-dimensionality, like some conflict within the character, and they saw him play such a wonderful bad guy, they almost didn't think that he could add nuance to that, because they wanted that plus, you know, plus some more depth and conflict later on, as happens to his character. They were afraid that he was unable to portray that because of how well he did in The Patriot.
Hmm.
Just a fun fact for you. I thought that was a great story, but they took a chance and cast him anyway, and he delivered because he's awesome.
And he also has done quite a bit of voice work. He's played Ra's al Ghul once or twice in various ways. I forget who else, but he's been in a bunch of DC animation. So he's going to be playing the captain.
Mm-hmm.
On the show. I'm not sure if he's going to be a regular character or just recurring. I'm reminded of the original conception for the West Wing was that the idea is that you would follow the staff.
Right.
The little people, quote unquote, and you would maybe occasionally see the president, but he wouldn't be a regular character on the show. But then, of course, Martin Sheen enjoyed shooting the pilot so much that they really restructured the show around him. But this is
going to include him more. You should say that.
Well, I mean, he was the. I think you could argue in an ensemble, he was the first among. I would say it's much in the same way that, you know, who was the star of Star Trek: The Next Generation? Patrick Stewart. Even though it was an ensemble show, if you're the captain of the ship or if you're the president of the United States and the show focused on the American government, then you're the star.
I guess you would have to say top billing, but there are lots and lots of episodes that don't even.
Well, Martin Sheen had final billing. It said "and Martin Sheen" at the end of the credits.
Right.
It always started with Rob Lowe because the idea was that he was the biggest name. He was going to be the quote-unquote star of the show. So it went Rob Lowe, then everybody else was alphabetical, and then it said "and Martin Sheen" at the end.
Right.
But anyway, so he's going to be the captain. So
they
announced the name of the character, too. I don't remember what it is. I'm bad at remembering names.
Is he
going
to be a good guy or a bad guy? This is the first time I think I've seen him play a really good guy.
The captain of a Federation ship. He's not going to be a bad guy.
Well.
It'd be interesting to see whether he plays kind of
more roguish side kind of politician, or is he going to go with like the man of the people?
Starfleet captains aren't really roguish. I think it's just going to be... I think the fact that the show isn't about him isn't to say that he's going to play a different role in the show than a captain normally plays. It's just that the show won't be focused on him.
Right.
Just like there are episodes of other Star Trek shows that didn't focus on the captain. This will be like that, but all the time. And he'll just be in there, but he might not be in every episode, or he might just be you know, a smaller percentage of the screen time than the other characters are.
I'm super excited. I can't wait. That's a casting choice I wouldn't have seen coming, actually, but I'm really excited about it.
We don't know when it's going to be airing, because, of course, it was going to be May, but then they pushed it back again. Now, apparently, the executives are saying, like, late summer, maybe? So, I don't know. I mean, it's got people worried that there might... What with... Brian Fuller. What with Brian Fuller having left the production
right.
a while ago, now this has got people worried that they're scrambling to... put the show together or something. I don't think that's the case. I just think that because they're not beholden to the fall schedule or the spring schedule, because it's going to be an online. I mean, it's going to air, you know, simultaneously on broadcast for the first couple of episodes and then go online only. So because it's not tied to the seasonal schedule, they can just take the time and do it on their own schedule. So yeah, they probably need to. There was probably some behind the scenes scrambling just to get somebody else into that. Into the showrunner position,
right.
But after that was done, I don't think they threw out the scripts or recast anybody. I think it's just they needed a couple of months to move some chess pieces around, and now they're just taking their time with it. That's the sense that I get from the interviews.
Right.
People are nervous because they want the show to be really good. So as we indicated last week, we have our Nintendo Switch.
Yay!
And we've been playing a lot
of... This is in the news section?
It's news.
It's our news.
We've been playing a lot of Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
A lot of it.
So we will probably talk about the game a little bit, but we might want to hold off on full discussion of the game until we've played more of it, because we're probably only maybe like 10-15%.
We also don't want to spoil any parts of it for somebody who hasn't got their hands on it yet.
So let's restrict our discussion more to the system itself. And we should also refer, is this what you were going to say?
The video.
So go ahead.
Oh, okay. yes,
you did most of the work, so.
We made a unboxing video, and we have it up online on our brand spanking new YouTube channel, which you can find, I think I put it youtube.com/smartspodcast, I hope. And if not, then it's youtube.com/smarts. But
there was a link in the show notes last week to our channel, and I'll put a link to the specific video in the show notes for this episode.
Yep.
So it'll be easy enough for
people
to find.
And I already tweeted it, so you can check out our Twitter page for that. And also it's on Facebook as well. So it's everywhere. I think it was a lot of fun, and the controllers have continued to look awesome. And I just in the video we talked, you mentioned that you read that the controller has a secret message. I tweeted you a link to tell
you. I didn't
have
time to look at it yet.
So I found where the secret message is. So it's very exciting. Okay, that's really it. What else do you want to say about the Switch?
Well, I mean, what are your thoughts on it so far? Like, what do you think of the build quality? What do you think of the quality of the screen? What do you think about the whole experience of you know, docking and undocking it, using it on the TV, attaching the controllers, the user interface, like the menus and all that stuff?
I like the menus. I haven't gotten to test the battery life or anything like that, because usually I just play it while it's docked and I play it on the TV. The menus are really easy to handle. I like how smart it is and how easily it just interfaced with our existing setup and our TV. I mean, we just plugged in a cable and the menus are smart enough to go into sleep mode and wake up whenever, without us having to use three remotes in order to get to the part where we get to play now. I like the controllers. They feel nice and sturdy and grippy, and I enjoy the game. So that's really my immediate feedback based on my limited experience with it, because all we've been playing is Breath of the Wild, and I haven't been taking the console out and about, so I just have the TV experience to speak to.
Yeah, we played it mostly on the TV. I think we only played it for maybe 15 minutes.
Yeah,
lying in bed with the thing kind of propped up. That's the one knock of the system, is that the kickstand is not very
good.
It's not centered, it's flimsy, it can't really support the weight terribly well, and it flops over at an angle. Because of the way it's positioned,
it has to be on a table that's already sturdy and can't wiggle too much.
But there have been penny arcade strips about this. There's actually like it's actually a running gag within the video game community that every new piece of Nintendo hardware has some weird physical flaw that's like, oh, if they would only fix this one thing, it would be perfect. Like, the one system had a non-standard headphone jack, and the other system had like a really, really dim screen, and that didn't have a backlight. And then this other, you know, so there's always one thing.
Yeah. know, there's just sun. one little weirdness.
The kickstand is the weird thing for this.
It's otherwise beautiful, but has like a gnarled tooth coming out of the side of its nose. Like yeah.
But it's really good. I'm enjoying it so far. And apparently it's been selling really well. And Breath of the Wild set a new record for a launch game for a Nintendo system, beating the previous record holder, which I think was Mario 64 from like 20 years ago, whenever that was. So yeah, it seems like it's doing really well. So we'll have more detailed impressions of Zelda, you know, probably in a few weeks once we've played more of it.
Right.
So the other exciting video game related thing is that this past weekend, we both attended PAX East.
So much fun.
Which, for people that don't know, is an East Coast offshoot of the video game convention PAX, which is normally held in Seattle and is put on by the people behind the Penny Arcade webcomic, which is a webcomic about mostly video game culture, nerd culture, also like a lot of slice of life stuff in there. And so we went to the convention and we saw some panels with the Penny Arcade creators and some that were not related to that specifically. We walked around the expo hall, tried some indie games, did a little bit of shopping, bought some souvenirs. We went to, what else did we do? We went to the big Acquisitions Incorporated.
It was a lot of fun.
Panel.
Green Flame!
We talked about Acquisitions Incorporated a bit last week, so we went to the big Acquisitions Incorporated game and a few other things. Some of the most, we talked also that some of the most fun we had was at panels that we didn't necessarily expect. We want to kill an hour and get off of our feet for an hour, so let's go to this panel. There was one about the history of a war in the online game EVE Online, which was really, really interesting.
I didn't know anything about this game community. There's a historian, basically, who gave this presentation, and the way he constructed everything, I'm so glad he's a writer because he's found his calling. The way that he assembled all of this information and presented it, it had us all on a roller coaster ride. I was riveted. I was on the edge of my seat, and I've never heard of EVE Online. I don't particularly know how folks can sink so much time and money into online gaming like that much, you know, like it seems that they spend like 3 hours a day doing that. Some people who are more passionate probably even sink more time into it, but I can completely understand now. I walked away with a certain understanding of like, I'm not surprised. Like folks form communities, they form bonds that are beyond just sitting at the computer all the time. It's actually a very real connection and a real fun way to spend some time and complete objectives together. So some folks put together propaganda videos for this alliance versus that alliance, and it was incredibly interesting and fun. And the guy who put together had a book that he wrote based on the history leading up to a certain series of battles and wars within this community. And it was really interesting. It was very, very interesting and a lot of fun.
I also really enjoyed the App Junkies panel.
That was hysterical.
Before the panel, they had downloaded a couple of dozen weird weird iOS apps. Games onto their phone, and they randomly went through them and played a few minutes of a bunch of different ones. So
they had weird, a really weird, nice panel
weird
set up.
Shovelware caching games, weird Korean games that with with mangled English, weird everything.
Just weird concepts too. It was hilarious. It was a lot of fun. I think I actually downloaded a couple of them because they were so funny.
Well, I think that llama game is probably saw more downloads in the past few days than it saw in the past, because it hasn't been updated in 4.5 years.
Yeah.
And I bet it got a couple dozen downloads over the weekend. And
some people might be buying that super special diamond.
The developers
llama
are going to get a check for $12 in the mail and not know what the heck is going on, because they probably forgot they even made the app. So it was a lot of fun. And just overall, I really enjoyed the weekend. I mean, the lines were long to get in to the convention center, especially
panels
in the cold. And then the lines to get into some of the more popular panels were crazy long, especially the Acquisitions Incorporated one.
But overall, I thought everything was incredibly well done. Oh, I had some notes to shout out to some folks that we bumped into and had really pleasant conversations with. There was a lady that gave me a button right at the end as I was leaving. She's in charge of the she was an enforcer in charge of the bee room, because they had like different animals for different conference rooms and stuff. And she and there were people that we were playing games with people that were entertaining people while they were waiting in line. And it was just really, really well done. The enforcers are awesome. It's just so great. and everything. I mean, they had line tape. They had special like colored tape on the floors to tell people where to stand. So everybody knows what's expected of them. Nobody's bumping, shoving, and, you know, limited resources, behaving like animals in this. No, everybody is just structured and really polite and patient. And it was a positive experience, even though some of these panels really filled up quick and those lines got full. But, you know, we were corralled very successfully, and I hope we were pleasant sheeple to deal with.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
It was a great time. It was so much fun.
So what's your comic of the week?
So honorable mention to my favorite Gotham Academy, but because they had a really beautiful art piece, and I'm there was a bit of a spoiler. I'm not going to say anything because it was so revolutionary, and I kind of called it ahead of time, and this turn in the story happened to be exactly the turn I thought, and I'm very excited about it. But my comic of the week this week is New Superman issue number 9. Yay, I remembered. The reason being, there's nothing wrong with a great setup issue. Number one, the art is awesome. I love it. Number two, I'm a sucker for playing with languages. So the fact that Lex Luthor spoke perfect Mandarin but feigned a certain degree of ignorance while collecting information, the teacher that... Oh, what's the main character's name? The kid, the
well,
new
now
Superman.
You said it. Now, how's it pronounced? Kanan?
Yeah, Kanan. So his mentor came along with him on this trip to America with Lex Luthor. And the three of them are having a conversation. The reason the teacher came along is to serve as a translator between Luthor and Kanan. And
is it Kanan or Kanan?
Kanan.
It's Kanan, right?
Yes, Kanan.
That's how it looks anyway, but I my Chinese
K-E-N-A-N? Yeah.
K-E-N-A-N, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yes. But anyway, yeah, the language play on that, the few joke moments here and there where Kanan being a sort of crazy teenager, for lack of a better summation, he's saying pretty rude things, but Luthor is not letting it slip that he can perfectly understand him, so... I like that element of it. I like a good setup to an interesting baddie that they're going to face in next issue. And I like the fact that Luthor is pretty complicated because he thinks he's doing a good thing. He genuinely believes that something that he's plotting, which to us is evil, is actually a pretty good idea and rooted in logic and sensibility. I like that element about the bad guy because... It's easy to make somebody evil for evil's sake. It's easy to make somebody who's evil and self-aware that he's evil, but sort of justified and whatever. But this guy, almost to a certain degree, for all of his genius, genuinely doesn't get it. Genuinely doesn't has a piece of him missing that tells him, that's a little evil. And that part of this story and of Luthor's characterization is always interesting to me. So anyway, I really enjoyed this issue, and that's why it was my favorite this week.
Yes, I enjoyed it too.
What did you pick for your comic of the week?
So mine's a little unpredicted this week. So I picked the final issue of a series that you do not read.
Ooh.
But it is a DC series. It's just that you don't read it.
Okay.
So this is Earth 2 Society, number 22. I won't go into the whole long history of this series and why it came to an end. But DC tried to do in the new 52, they tried to do a new version of the Earth 2 concept. So... characters with familiar names like the Flash, Green Lantern, and so on, but alternate versions of them. And they had the names that you would expect the Earth 2 versions of these characters to have, like Jay Garrick and Alan Scott and so on like that. But they, instead of having them be the old veteran characters, they did like a younger reboot of those characters and gave the world a different feel. The origins of the characters were more based in myth than in science. And Wonder Woman was the first superhero to go public on that earth. So they were called Wonders as opposed to superheroes. Because the word superhero is derived from Superman. So if Wonder Woman was the first, why would they call them superheroes? They would call them Wonders. And there are all sorts of little interesting little touches like that. It was originally written by James Robinson, who was great. He did Starman back in the day, which is a classic. Eventually, he left the series over editorial disagreements with DC. They brought in Tom Taylor, who's also great. And to me, the series kept being really good there, but then DC decided to basically blow up Earth 2 and move the other characters in this big crossover, this big weekly crossover, and move the characters to a new planet that they would have to try to survive on. Mm-hmm. And it got repetitive because it just felt like misery porn. Like everything was blowing up all the time. Characters were dying. One planet would explode. They'd move to another planet. Then it turned out that planet was uninhabitable. And it really got away from what it was originally supposed to be, which is a modern retelling of the Justice Society characters, but done in the present. With youthful versions, like they were originally when they were created in the 40s. They weren't always the old veteran characters. They're originally as young as the modern characters are supposed to be. But it got away from that. And so Dan Abnett, who we really enjoy these days as the writer of Titans and Aquaman, was brought on board about a year ago to try to right the ship, or at the very least to run out the clock until they decided to cancel it. I'm not quite sure what their intentions were. And he did great work on it, but there's only so much you can do. The concept at that point had kind of been irreparably damaged. And
right.
He was able to sort of give the characters a do-over. The Earth was sort of reborn. Their Earth, Earth 2, was sort of reborn. But the characters that we'd been following were carried over to the new Earth. And so now they had this new world to protect that wasn't always being destroyed, and it was more stable and more familiar. And so it ended on a nice note where all the characters we'd followed for the last few years finally got a peaceful, non-constantly exploding Earth to look after, and mantles were passed, and the characters found, you know, new places for themselves. And it was a really nice send off. There weren't really any fights in this final issue. It was just here's the characters. Now they found this new home and they're all doing good, and mm-hmm. the adventures will continue in the future. And that was the way it wrapped up. So mm-hmm. it was really good. I question, it's too bad because I really enjoyed the early Earth 2 stories a few years ago before it really went off the rails. And I wonder, given that one of the big obvious holes in the current Rebirth lineup, aside from, you know, when are they going to bring Shazam into Rebirth? When are they going to bring the Legion into Rebirth? One of the other big holes is the Justice Society. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling if they bring the Justice Society back in the current Rebirth comics, it's going to be the version of the Justice Society that the fans are clamoring for, which is like the older veteran characters, Jay Garrick, Alan Scott, the classic versions of them that are old enough to have fought in World War II and to be the mentors of the current
right.
generation.
Yep.
So given that, I'm not quite sure there's going to be a place for these new, younger, modern versions of Jay Garrick and Alan Scott mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. I think that they're going to probably continue to live on Earth 2, whereas the Justice Society we're more familiar with will be reinstated on the main Earth
yep.
as the predecessors to the current characters that were just forgotten because of...
Right.
You know... various reasons. And so these other characters, we imagine, will continue to live out their happy lives on Earth 2, whereas mm-hmm. the Justice Society will be back on Earth 0 with all their history intact, and everybody will be happy. And maybe we'll see these other versions of the characters again the next time there's a big multiverse-spanning crossover.
Right.
But I hope we see them again. They did some interesting stuff there. The Superman of this cast was a black man. Val Zod, mm-hmm. And so you had, you know, a black Superman, which was a really cool concept. They had the Batman of Earth 2 was revealed to be Thomas Wayne, because Bruce Wayne Batman had died, which is similar to the Flashpoint which is what you're familiar
yes.
with, but this is a different thing. But it's kind of where they got the idea for that, I think, an older grizzled Thomas Wayne whose son had died, and so he had taken up the mantle,
right.
as opposed to Bruce taking up the mantle because his father had died. They had an Aqua Woman over there. She was really interesting. Queen Morella, I think her name was. They had an interesting new take on Dr. Fate. Alan Scott on Earth 2 was gay, and so that gave them a new interesting angle to play. They did a lot of interesting things with the characters, but it didn't last. The concept went off the rails due to, you know, editorial mismanagement, and they had to shut the whole thing down. But I really enjoyed it as an ending, and I hope we see these versions of the characters again.
Cool. Cool pick. Nice.
And if and when they show up again, I'll probably have to explain to you who they are, because
yes,
you'll be like, wait, who's this other Alan Scott? And it will be confusing. But
yeah, you'll definitely get more out of the
It seems weird that there could be multiple Jay Garricks and Alan Scotts, but I guess if like most Earths have a Bruce Wayne, there's no reason why there can't be multiple Alan Scotts and Jay Garricks. I'm
sure.
Just used to them being the alternate versions of our guys.
Right.
And not there also being alternate versions of them, but I guess there's no reason why there couldn't be.
Right, sure, why not?
So you want to go into your pop quiz?
I am ready for my pop quiz.
So this week I'm going to quiz you about Penny Arcade.
We just went to PAX. I really hope I don't fall flat on my face. Oh, that's a good quiz topic. Okay.
So this is a shorter quiz, only 5 questions.
Oh, all right. I hope I do well.
So we'll see how well you do. So number one.
Number one.
Who created Penny Arcade?
Oh, yes. Jerry Holkins and Mike Krahulik.
That is correct.
Yay.
Mork Krahalo.
Mork Krahalo and Pony Arcade.
That's right.
Yes.
Number two.
Mm-hmm.
What are the full names of the two main characters?
Tycho Brahe and Gabe.
Not quite. Tycho Brahe.
Oh, no. I'm failing. Terrible.
Tycho Brahe.
Brahe. Oh.
And
see, my dyslexia shaved off the top of the H there and turned it into an N. Anyway.
And who else?
Gabe. Whoa, now I'm blanking. Oh, no. I suck. Oh, no.
That's okay. You actually haven't read that much of the comic.
Gabe.
Gabe's full name is Jonathan Gabriel. The Gabe is a...
Is it a nickname? Okay. Well,
there you go.
What do I get? Like,
I guess you get
half a point.
Half
I guess.
A point because you got half of each of their names.
Number three.
What is the name of their cat?
Mister. There was merch everywhere. Mister.
No, there wasn't. Well, he was on some of the merch.
I almost got the water bottle. I kind of regret not getting it now.
I think you can get that. Mister.
Mister. Mister. Tompkins. Mister. Thickens, Mr. Tomlins?
Not quite. Thomas Kemper.
Thomas. That's why I had the top. Okay. Thomas right. Kemper. Kemper.
Yes. Number four.
Uh-huh.
Name 4 other Penny Arcade projects / spinoffs.
Okay.
4 other endeavors under the Penny Arcade umbrella, other than just the thrice weekly webcomic. Regardless of media.
Regardless of media. Okay, so Acquisitions Incorporated.
That's one.
That's a YouTube series. What about the YouTube series where they were following people in the office, like the actual
Penny Arcade? You can say Penny Arcade TV.
Let's see. They did Strip Search.
That was a season of Penny Arcade TV. I don't think I can give you that one.
All right. Well, as a result of Strip Search, they hired the winner. Katie's Strip, though.
I mean, I guess it's on the Penny Arcade website. I guess I can give
you
that one.
I was going to say,
Camp. That's not really...
Because Camp, you don't watch it.
The two guys aren't involved in that at all, though. So that's... To me, I don't really consider that to be a Penny Arcade project. It's just hosted on
their
site.
Well, okay, so fine. So their charity is Child's Play.
Child's Play is a good one, yeah.
And I know...
You're missing a couple of obvious ones.
Well, I'm doing their YouTube channel. I just named... A lot. Did I get to 4
Well,
yet?
If you don't feel like you deserve Camp We Don't Want You, then you're at 3 right now.
Do you feel I did?
I'll give it to you if you want. It's on the Penny Arcade website. It's right there, so I guess I can give it to you. I mean, I guess that qualifies because she's part of the Penny Arcade company, technically, and it's on the website, so I can give you that. But some of the other obvious ones you missed were PAX, right? That's a Penny Arcade project. That's part of the Penny Arcade umbrella. You missed the whole Ironwood Lookout Thornwatch thing.
Well, yeah.
Automata is another project that they, another world that they created that's now becoming a short film. So those are some of the other ones. I thought you'd remember Acquisitions Incorporated. I thought you'd say PAX. I thought you might say Child's Play.
Well, I wouldn't have thought of PAX as a under this because we just went to PAX. So of course I was like, oh, well, I mean, it's a.
Yeah, but that's good. I'll give you a full point for that one. Okay, and lastly, number 5.
Okay.
Name 4 other people that either currently work or have worked at Penny Arcade, aside from Mike and Jerry.
Scott Kurtz.
He worked in their offices. He was never an employee at Penny Arcade.
Yeah, he has his own work.
Yeah, but I'll give you that one.
Comics and stuff. And I honored him in the acronym because he did a beautiful sketch for us and of us, and it means so much to me, and we're gonna frame it and put it up, and I'm so excited. Okay, how about Robert Koo?
Yep.
Who only recently left and pretty much helped get us the company that we love and know. And let's
first
see,
names is enough for this. You don't need full names.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not sure I would even remember all their actually I think I do.
Levin.
Levin, that's one.
Levin,
yeah.
What's his last name? And then, oh, we saw him. Sad, that's right. And we saw Kiko taking pictures.
Yep, Kiko. Yeah, there's a bunch of others. There's, you know, there's Josh, Erica.
Yep.
Who later became Gavin.
Yep.
Forgetting a bunch of obvious ones. Robert, like you said, I mean, Chris Straub is there, works in the offices too. Katie is there also now, like you said. I'm forgetting a bunch of obvious ones. Oh, Mike Feilauer.
Yeah, Jeff, right. I was going to say
you know,
that.
Yeah, a bunch of other guys, yeah. And the name of Kristen Lindsay, who does the Child's Play stuff. Jamie, who we saw get hired to also run Child's Play.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
very good.
Super exciting.
I think, one, two.
Do the Cookie Brigade work for them, too?
3.5 I don't know. I don't know what the deal with that was.
They were everywhere. They were everywhere. And they were taking donations for Child's Play. And I bet they made a lot of money. They had a lot of cookies. They spent all of PAX baking. I ate so much
of their cookies. So you got 3.5 out of 5. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
You didn't get half of their names, and you didn't get the name of the cat.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah. Womp. Okay.
All right, so should we talk about our shows?
Yeah, let's talk about our shows.
So we only have 3 shows this week.
We should warn everybody, we have a few new listeners. So if you haven't seen this week's favorite shows, we're going to list each of the shows one at a time. But we watch a lot of comics shows, and we do talk about, you know, things that happened in the show. So if you're afraid of spoiling anything that you in episodes of Flash, Supergirl, Arrow.
So what did you think when all the characters died in that one episode?
Yeah, that was crazy. Okay, so you've been warned. You can skip to the end or just pause the episode here and come back if you feel uncomfortable about listening to what we think about our shows. Now we can proceed.
Okay.
Okay.
So this week's episode of Supergirl was Exodus.
Yep.
This was the whole...
Exodus episode?
Lillian Luthor has got a big ship. She's rounding up the aliens. Aliens are being kidnapped by Cadmus.
Oh, Lillian.
Alex, because she was sort of, I don't know, shamed is probably too strong a word, but because she was sort of...
she was shaken. I think that's
out,
the best way.
Called out and then sidelined by Jean for still wanting to trust Jeremiah, takes it upon herself to infiltrate Cadmus and sort of wage a one-woman war on Cadmus, remarkably effectively, actually.
I know, right? It was like, why didn't they let her do this?
Up until the point where she got trapped in the ship and she would have been sent off to Tacron Galtos, which is the prison planetoid from Legion of Superheroes, by the way. That's where the ship was going.
That was a reference I didn't get. I'm glad you explained that.
Although here they just said it's like a way station they'll find their way back. So it's just a name. They just use the name, I think.
It's like anywhere but here. Okay. Great.
It's like Space Iron Heights, basically, or Space Arkham, whereas here they just made it sound like it was a place where they're, oh, don't worry, they'll be able to find their way back home.
And,
or at least that's what Jeremiah was telling himself, anyway.
Yeah.
It's always a thing in these shows when someone who's ostensibly military or at least works for some form of law enforcement or the government goes way off the reservation and takes it upon themselves in a massive breach of protocol in the chain of command to do something, and there's zero repercussions. Because they're friends with the person running the show, which is, you know, exemplified here, where because she and John are like family, she can massively disobey orders and almost get herself
hugely.
blown to kingdom come. You know, like
to the edge of the universe.
It ended up working out, but they almost lost her. She almost lost her life. They almost lost a number of valuable assets, right? Like, who's to say they weren't planning some other? You see it in cop shows all the time where they're actually planning a sting operation. They got an undercover man, but the lone cop goes in and blows the whole operation, you know?
Yeah.
Like, for all she knew, that could have been underway here. So, I mean, everything worked out only because Supergirl showed up. Otherwise, they would have lost everything.
Yeah.
But Jeremiah and Lillian got away. Henshaw got away. They almost lost all the aliens. She could have gotten killed.
Yep.
And there's zero repercussions. And in fact, Jean apologized to her for doing his job and assessing her mental fitness to be a field agent.
Yeah.
So I was actually a little
underwhelmed with the ending part of it too, because I felt like Wynn having an expertise over the battle stations, and they knew exactly what type of ship they were on, and they
that I'm he okay would, with. He,
it's I'm his, not it's super
his,
okay with
it's
it.
It's his job to do tech stuff with alien technology. So
literally his job. That's like what he's supposed to do. And he couldn't really. He said, "Hit this button on the thing." She tried it. It didn't work, and he didn't have a plan.
Your problem is that he wasn't effective enough.
Yes,
I thought your problem was that he knew which button to hit without ever having seen the show.
No, I'm. They went down that hole and then kind of backtracked out
okay
of it because
that
they
too.
Wanted
like
the
was,
whole pushing down
it had
thing.
Been, but they already,
I think
they,
he could have
they
found
set up
a way.
That it was, they set up that it was pre-programmed to go to Tacron Galtos,
yep,
right?
Because
there was no
fine.
Pilot, there was no crew.
That's cool.
So it was basically stuck on some super advanced form of autopilot, and there was nothing he could do without being able to interface
what
with it.
What about cutting power to the engines?
How would he...
He could tell her what her off switch is. Like,
but
it's,
maybe the autopilot. I don't know. Here I am defending an alien operating system. Yeah. But I don't find it hard to believe. I don't find it hard to believe that an alien ship is technologically sophisticated enough that there's a mode you can put it in to prevent people from messing with it. Right? Like, it should have a mode like that. Our stuff should have a mode like that. It's just that it doesn't because we're not technologically advanced enough. If there was a mode you could put our airplanes in such that they could never be sabotaged
disabled remotely,
then you would put them in that mode. So I was okay with that. The whole thing of Supergirl, I was actually unsure whether Supergirl would succeed because the way the music,
the tone
of the music and the way it was playing out made me believe that maybe this was going to be a cliffhanger where she fails and Alex is seemingly lost and that's several episodes before they're able to find her, for example.
If they had shot her out at the speed of light across the galaxy, I don't think there's a way to come back from that because Earth doesn't have technology to go to travel that way.
But then the Daxamites show up and maybe they use Daxamite technology. Okay. Like they could write their way out of anything they wanted to, but I thought that might have been the way they were going. They decided not to do it.
Okay, fair enough.
Speaking of the Daxamites.
Yes.
So we have, I guess it's not confirmed in this episode in the dialogue. That the people that have been following Mon-El and that we see revealed in this episode as Terry Hatcher and Kevin Sorbo are the Daxamites,
right?
Specifically the Daxamite royal family and the persons of those two actors. But, I mean, this is what we've been heavily supposing, and this is what all the press materials and so on strongly lead me to believe. So I think that's probably safe to say that my theory was correct and that it turns out that Mon-El is actually going to be the Prince of Daxam, not just a member of the Royal Guard.
So that story that he told in the very beginning was a reversal.
Yeah, like he had actually, like that's the reason why his friend had put him in the capsule instead of himself was because he thought it was more important for the prince to survive than just some.
Right.
You know, he reversed their positions, basically.
Yep.
And that Terry Hatcher and Kevin Sorbo are therefore going to be playing his parents.
Yep.
So we saw them briefly at the end of the episode. It was cool to see them. I think that they're going to play. They're in the very next episode. They're going to be playing a major role going forward. There's no episode of Supergirl this week. So we have to wait till next week to see that.
Super cliffhanger.
And so the episode after that will fully introduce their characters and also set up the musical crossover with The Flash. So it's going to be a busy episode. I'm waiting to see how they balance those two plot
threads. Yeah, I know.
Threads.
I'm your evil dad. Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm enjoying seeing Al. I mean, I would say that after the first season, Alex and Wynn were the two characters I think needed the most development. The first season focused a lot on Kara and James because the whole will-they-won't-they relationship. So James had a lot bigger role in the first season. And then we find out that Henshaw was Jean and he got a lot of development too.
Yep.
Cat Grant got a lot of development. Now she's not around anymore. But Wynn and Alex, to me, weren't as fully fleshed out. This season, we've been getting a lot more Alex. We've been getting,
moving Wynn
from Catco to the DEO was probably smart because now becoming clear, they're not spending nearly as much time in Catco as they used to. There's
giving
not as much to do there, right? Like Cat's gone. James is running the operation, but he and Kara don't have an adversarial relationship. So there's not really as much drama to play with them butting heads as there was with Kara and Kat, who had sort of a fiery relationship.
Right.
She's butting heads with Snapper, but he's not really a regular. He shows up when you need him. I am feeling that James isn't getting as much to do this season. They've given him the Guardian thing, but it's been a few episodes since we've really moved that along. So they're coming back to him, I imagine, at some point. But anyway, it's my long way of saying that I am enjoying that they've really fleshed out Alex's character this season, obviously with her sexuality and with Maggie and all the other stuff. But they've also been doing a good job of giving her a lot more action stuff to do instead of just being there and a support for Supergirl.
Right.
As much as I feel like she kind of went off the reservation this episode without repercussions, but that's just the way it is in TV series. Is that she has plot armor basically. She has main character immunity where, you know, and unless the writers decide that she's going to die, she's not going to get killed because of some stupid mistake she did or get fired from the DEO because she's a main character.
Right.
So that's just the way it is. But I thought it was a really enjoyable episode. Like I said, there were parts where I was legitimately didn't know what they were going to do, thought they were going to go in a different direction. We saw more of Dean Cain.
Yep.
We found out a bit more about his motivations that he...
It's what
we suspected. They threatened his daughters. That's the obvious thing. But also, moreover, he thought that he could
minimize the damage
to the alien population by, because I'm trying to remember exactly what they say because it was a week ago.
He said that Lillian wanted to kill all the aliens.
Yes, of course.
And
he convinced them that it would actually be easier, I guess. I wonder how he convinced her of that because this really didn't seem, that's a big ship.
Yeah.
How is this easier than just shooting them all?
Yeah.
But
I think he, maybe there was something.
You could make that argument, but I, it would be.
You could make that argument, like, but they didn't.
You'd have to convince her that, well, maybe like if you kill all these people, even though they're expats from other planets, it could incur the wrath of their people. They could come to Earth.
Right.
Like
there are sympathizers here.
There are arguments you could make.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would bring more heat on you from the DEO and so on. Whereas
from
this
the public
way,
as well.
PR-wise, you could try to spin it that they just sent them back to their, Poochie died on his way back to his home planet as opposed to actually shooting, you know?
Yes.
So.
Oh, Simpsons did it.
So they kind of hand-waved that away a little bit, but I think it did a good job of preserving his integrity as a character.
Yes.
That you could sort of see that it would work
and
that
she
way.
Was, Alex got to actually, in a way, she was vindicated. Her entire path and her entire belief system was vindicated in this moment because she was right. Her father could have been convinced, and if she weren't there, maybe he would have been shot up, you know?
Maybe, but if
But in the very end, it was because she was able to get through to him and say, you know, like, you already believe these things, but you have to look around and see that the actions you're taking based on these beliefs are incorrect actions.
It's
like,
hard to
you
say,
can fix it the better way.
It's hard to say in hindsight because, yes, she was correct that he could be reached. But if he had really shown up in her apartment at the beginning of this episode instead of Jean.
Yes.
I mean, maybe and had said to her exactly what Jean had said.
Right.
And she had believed him.
Yeah.
Maybe that would have been just another trick. He tricked her once before in the previous episode.
Yes.
Just because his heart is in the right place doesn't mean he's above tricking them, because that's literally what he
what
did in the previous episode.
Exactly.
So she might have been wrong to trust him. If it had been him and not John.
Yes.
You know, his motivations aside, it doesn't mean he can be trusted. So, you know, it turns out everything worked out, aside from the fact that he's, you know,
it's one of those situations where both sides were right, you know.
Yeah.
Because I think Jean was right to sideline her. And
yeah, I think that's totally justified.
I thought that was absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was a great show.
It was a good episode.
Yeah.
So this episode of The Flash was The Wrath of Savitar.
Dum dum dum.
So this had some cool stuff that happened in it.
Love good
I liked all. I liked all the Wally stuff.
Yeah.
It was clever too. I didn't see the whole thing coming with that he'd actually, because to my mind I'd gotten a little confused about Savitar's status. I knew that they threw the Philosopher's Stone into the Speed Force.
Yes.
I remembered that.
Yep.
But in my head, I was thinking, well, Savitar is trapped somewhere. He's trapped in the Speed Force too, isn't he? Like,
I thought so.
Like, it turns out that's what was revealed in this episode.
Yes.
But that wasn't what the characters thought going into this episode. They just knew that he was a speedster from the future.
Mm-hmm. And
who was somehow appearing through the Philosopher's Stone in their minds, right?
Right.
So by throwing the Philosopher's Stone into the Speed Force, that would prevent Savitar from manipulating them from the future.
Yep.
What they didn't realize is that he's not, even though he's from the future, he's not in the future right now, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
He is actually in the Speed Force.
Yes.
And so they were giving him what he wanted.
Right.
So because I was a little unclear on that, I was like, when they discovered that, I'm like, wait, isn't that what they thought already? Turns out it was. Like, now I'm clear on what they thought before, but because I was confused before, that didn't really land with me as well as it could have. But it was an interesting reversal that in thinking that they had sent the Philosopher's Stone away, that actually given him what they wanted, if it weren't for the fact that Caitlin had kept this one small piece.
Right.
Which, I read a review of this episode that said that they wish this episode hadn't had quite so much forced melodrama. Like, Caitlin kept a piece of the Philosopher's Stone, but she didn't tell anyone. And because she didn't tell anyone, it caused all these other problems,
right?
Like, Barry had this secret reason for proposing to Iris, and because he didn't tell her, like, if he proposed to her, like, this is of course, you know, me writing a different version
of
the show
now,
but it's
these are
some of the things that the CW shows fall into sometimes, where the forced melodrama, characters keeping secrets from each other when they don't have to.
If
Barry had said to Iris, maybe this would have worked, maybe it wouldn't have, but to me it would have been more true to his character. I mean, Barry has always kind of kept things from other characters to try to own benefit.
For protection.
Oliver does the same thing. That's a superhero thing to do, right? The entire concept of the secret identity is rooted in that conceit that you better to keep. So, fine. But if Barry had said to Iris, I want to marry you. Who knows? Neither of us know how much time we'll have left together. It could be 3 months. It could be 30 years. It could be whatever. But I want to marry you now because we don't know what the future is going to hold. And who knows? Maybe this will be just the thing to change our destinies and ensure that we have a future together.
Exactly.
Is by proving our love for each other right now, as opposed to waiting for a future that may or may not come. That might have worked. It might not have worked.
Right.
But doing it the way he did it, like, it's understandable from a character perspective, but it just smacked to me of, again, forced melodrama. And the way that Wally, after discovering So two things. One, then, after Wally messes, after Wally keeps from the others that he's been seeing Savitar, again,
yes,
why keep that secret?
Right.
When he revealed to them that he'd been seeing Savitar, Barry immediately blows up at him and says, okay, that's it, you're out, kid.
Right, yeah.
Which I get that Barry's under a lot of pressure. I get that he wants to save Iris. I get that they can't afford to keep secrets from each other right now.
Sure.
So I buy that he'd be angry. But then, so he blows up at Wally, which may or may not be in character. And then Wally gets so angry at Barry that then he blows up Barry's engagement to Iris by revealing that Iris wasn't wearing the ring
in the future.
And so it's all characters undermining each other,
yeah,
keeping secrets from each other, and resenting each other, which is a source for drama, yes, but I feel like this show works best when the characters are all like a happy team
on
the same side, Team Flash, right? Arrow, you can have a bit more drama between the characters. You're like, you know, Curtis and Wild Dog.
That's a different dynamic.
They don't agree about gun laws.
They're still developing a friendship.
Or Diggle maybe is unsure if he can trust Oliver at certain points, or Oliver and Felicity are on the outs or whatever. But I feel like Team Flash, you want to be like, Team Flash, go. And then the Legends team, they're always bickering, fighting. That's just the way that show works.
Exactly.
Because they're all dysfunctional in one way or another.
Right.
Team Flash, I feel like, You want to see them be like raw team, and when they're not, you want it to be because they're up against something that's more powerful
than
them.
And they're
whatever,
working.
Right? And they're unsure if they can do it. Like Wally not being sure if he's going to be fast enough to save Iris.
Or to face through
that's
objects.
In character.
Like that was
right. That's in character. And the other characters talk to him and help him through his problems.
Exactly.
Like, they can have doubts. They can
have drama that's not rooted in their interpersonal relationships.
Right. I just felt like this episode was really piling on the force melodrama.
Yes.
And the other issue I had, do you want to say yours first?
Yeah.
Okay, you say yours first.
Because to tag on to your proposal note, I noticed something else too. During Barry's proposal in the previous episode to this, he said how much he had history in the ring that he was giving to her, how it was his mother's ring, how his father had given it to the, how it had belonged to his grandmother, how Joe had kept it for him until he got it back from him. How did Joe get the ring to Barry without having the discussion of, because then in this episode he said, why didn't you ask me? Like that entire story, you didn't even ask me.
I guess if I thought of that, I would have just assumed that Joe wasn't keeping it until Barry asked for the purpose of proposing to someone. Joe had given it to Barry a while ago when he became an adult for when you need it.
Barry literally said until today that he had a discussion with him earlier that day.
I don't remember
he
that.
Said
I'll
until
take your
today.
Word for it. I don't remember that specifically.
I remember that because I thought to myself in that moment, I was like, oh, he even had a chat with Joe about this. This is so great. World's greatest proposal. Yay.
I don't know. Maybe it was
cute.
One of those lines of dialogue that you could read either way. But I that didn't occur to me. I did really like the, I think we both kind of teared up a little bit because the, oh my God, I'm blanking on the actor that plays Joe. Anyway, it'll come to me. But he's so good.
He's wonderful.
At being like the TV dad, that when he teared up,
yes,
and responded the way he did to finding out that they were engaged, like that, you know, that just hits you.
That hit me. Oh, it was so good. I'm getting all choked up now.
But so you know, sandwich the good with the bad. But the other thing that irritated me a little bit about this episode is that the first time they channeled Savitar through Julian, a few episodes ago, mm-hmm, that was super dramatic. He gave that prophecy.
Yeah.
Right? That was super dramatic.
Now they're going back to that three times in the show.
They went back to it in this episode. I'm like, okay, I can understand. Like, it worked last time. It makes sense that they would want to try it again. But from a writing perspective, you don't want to be repeating yourself. Like,
right,
obviously, in real life, if you find something that works, you keep doing that thing,
sure,
right? But that's boring to watch on TV. So it worked. So they did it again here, and Julian's like, no, I don't want to do it. And they force him. So, like, that's fine because, like, that's drama. Like, he doesn't want to do it, but they're asking him to do it. He realizes the greater good, so he finally acquiesces. That's all fine. But then they do it a second time in this episode. And at that point, I was just kind of like, come on, guys. Like,
and a third, because you forgot the part where they hooked him back up to the machine, but then Barry just, like, ripped it out of him. You know, Matrix
style. Yeah, so they kept doing it. And so that, to me, it was a little bit diminishing returns. Like, it went from being ominous to kind of comical that they kept hooking Julian up to these machines.
Julian was super not happy. Yeah.
So to me, that was a little bit of, but the stuff that worked for me in this episode was, but I still enjoyed a lot of it. The stuff with Joe, I enjoyed the fact that while the fact that the team were keeping secrets from each other had consequences. And so even though it was felt a little forced from a writer's perspective, it wasn't just shrugged off.
Right.
Like, it had actual consequences. If Caitlin hadn't kept that piece, then, well, I guess if Caitlin hadn't kept that piece, they would have been screwed even earlier when they threw the Philosopher's Stone to the Speed Force, because it would have been whole then, and Savitar would have gotten his power back. But the fact that Wally ran off without finding out what was going on, thought that it was his job to throw, that he was helping by throwing that final piece into the Speed Force.
Yep.
Right? He went off the reservation, and unlike with Alex and Supergirl, that had actual consequences, because that allowed Savitar to come forth and put install Wally in his place in the Speed Force. So it's, I don't know, I hope that we find out more, and I know we will, because I think the next episode largely takes place in the Speed Force as Barry goes in there to try to get Wally, and we see cameos from characters that we might not expect, and it'll be a lot of fun. But I hope that they clarify, because when the only time we've been inside the Speed Force was when Barry was in there, and that was where, like, it looked like places he was familiar with, people he was familiar with. It felt like you were inside the Force, kind of, and these people were trying to guide him to come to a great realization about himself, and you had that great scene with he and his mother
reading
the children's book. But this time it felt like what Savitar was saying is, like, where Wally is right now, he's in, like, constant pain and torment, and he's trapped there for all eternity. Like, that's a different aspect of the Speed Force than we've ever seen before. Normally, when a speedster joins the Speed Force, it's like ascending to a higher level of existence. It's like being in heaven, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, in the comics, the Speed Force is essentially the afterlife for speedsters, and it's essentially heaven. Like, you want to go there when you die as a speedster. Mm. So the idea of being trapped there in a tormented reality, way,
that's
a different thing.
Different.
So I wonder if there's going to be a swerve there that we don't see coming. Like, maybe Savitar was lying about that, or maybe there's just different aspects of the Speed Force that we haven't seen. But Savitar wouldn't really have a reason to lie about that. Right? If anything, he should be telling them that Wally is in a better place now, so they're less likely to try to save him and put Savitar back in there, right?
That's funny.
So I don't know. We'll see where they go with that. But the next episode is...
Maybe it's terrible for him because he's such a terrible being. Maybe Wally's going to be rescued and be like,
So here's the other thing. So one last thing, and then we'll talk about Legends of Tomorrow. So we were given more clues, I would say, in this episode as to who Savitar is, or at the very least how he comes to be, right? Barry's responsible for his creation. It seems like he says, you're going to meet me very soon now.
Yeah.
Does that mean that he's a character that Barry hasn't met yet, or does that mean that he's currently a member of the cast? It's just that when he says, you haven't met me yet, it means that I haven't become Savitar yet. You haven't seen me as Savitar
yet. That's
what
I took it to mean. I took it to mean that, what you just said, that he creates somehow Savitar, which is kind of funny because it made me remember Reverse Flash, how Eobard Thawne blamed him for all of the badness.
Yeah,
like, you created me, Barry Allen. Well,
he didn't really, though.
How many
That's Thawne's psychosis. Like, Thawne...
And that's what I feel like Savitar is.
Thawne gave himself powers in an effort to be more like the Flash. To be better than the Flash, but then because Barry kept thwarting him, he became obsessed with being better than Barry and destroying Barry's life, right? But Thrawn really brought all that on himself. Barry's just was the good guy in that scenario. It's just that Thrawn sees himself as the good guy. But here, if Barry actually does literally, causally speaking, become responsible for turning whoever, you know, Cisco, Julian,
Supply
Joe,
name here,
whoever,
Savitar.
Wally,
yeah.
into Savitar, then that would be a different origin, a different motivation than, to me, we've seen so far. Because he didn't create Zoom. Hunter Zolomon did that to him. Well, the particle accelerator explosion on Earth 2 did that to Hunter Zolomon, but Zolomon was already a psychopath.
Yep.
Thawne was already obsessed and fixated on Barry Allen, and Barry, you know, being better than him was just enough to break his mind totally. But I don't know. Like, I think there was a bit where they kept asking Savitar, who are you? And he kept saying, I'm the future, Flash, right? And you read that as,
yes.
I'm the future, comma, Flash.
Right.
But what if he's saying, I'm the future, Flash, meaning I am you, Barry Allen, in the future? Or alternatively, I am Wally West in the future after Wally becomes the Flash, or something like that. What I'm saying is, what if there's a second way of reading that line?
Yeah, exactly. Because
there was a story in the comics recently where it wasn't Savitar. He still called himself the Flash, but there was a future version of Barry Allen that had lost everything, had become obsessed with fixing things, had this glowing blue Speed Force armor, and came back in time to try to set things right, and the current present Barry ended up opposing him. So it reminds me a little bit of that. Now, so I wonder if they're setting this up to be a future version of Barry Allen, which might also tie in to future Barry's warning to the Legends team about how they shouldn't trust him.
Oh, wow.
That's my theory. That this is, they're going to take the helmet off and it'll be Grant Gustin in like old age makeup or
Holy
something.
Holy moly. That's a thought.
So I don't know how you square that with "You'll meet me soon," because Barry isn't going to get old until he gets old, right? Like if this is 40-year-old Barry Allen, it's going to be 20 years before he meets, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I don't quite know how you square that, but that's my theory, is that he is the future version of a current speedster, which really just narrows it, I guess it could be Jay, but it, to me, narrows it down to either future Barry or future Wally. Those are my guesses, is one of those two. And I don't know whether they hire a different actor or whether they just put them in. I'm not sure you could age Keenan Lonsdale, who plays Wally, up to look like he's 60 and have it be convincing, you know?
Right.
They put some old age makeup on Stephen Amell in that one Legends episode, and that kind of hung together, but I'm not sure. But Grant Gustin is so youthful looking.
Yeah.
Stephen Amell's kind of grizzled and stubbly already that you could kind of make it work.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's just my theory. We'll see. Did you read that "I'm the future Flash" line?
No, I didn't.
Did you notice the possible double meaning in that?
I notice it now, but I didn't at the time.
So the fan money right now appears to be on it being Julian.
Yeah, the fact that's that
he
what
was,
I would
The fact that
guess.
He was also
that's
alchemy.
What I was guessing.
The fact that he was also alchemy is like a swerve, so you don't see it coming that he's
right.
actually Savitar.
Yep.
I don't know. Maybe, but again, they rarely go with the most expected thing, but they will often go with the thing that is truest to the comics, but it's not what the show has led you to think is going to happen. The idea of there being an evil future version of Barry is something that the comics have done. There's never been an evil future version of Wally that I can remember. There's been future older versions of Wally, but I don't think any of them have been evil. There's been plenty of evil speedsters in the future, of course, Reverse Flash being one of them, so there's precedent
there. So maybe that's why he wants to kill Iris in order to begin his path onto a dark future.
He wants to ensure his own existence by turning Barry down a dark path. Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, as far as his motivation is concerned. But anyway, we'll see. So this episode of Legends of Tomorrow, so this was Land of the Lost.
Okay.
You say,
switching
okay,
gears.
Okay.
No, sorry, it's switching gears.
Did you have
it's a little
else
harder
to say about
for me.
Flash?
No. It's just I like to take a little bit of a moment.
Buckle
and you're
up.
Just you're driving this bus. Let's go.
So the two aspects of this episode, the two threads in this episode, were Sarah and Jax going inside Rip's mind to try to free him and restore the Rip Hunter we know, and Nate, Amaya, and Ray traipsing through the
The
forests of Vancouver.
I wanted to say crustaceous.
Traipsing through the forests
like
of Vancouver.
Crustacean period, no.
Yeah, tracing through the forests of Vancouver, mm-hmm. masquerading as some ancient dinosaur times.
There we go.
It was the same when they went to Gorilla City in The Flash, the forests of Vancouver. Shouldn't those be rainforests? Shouldn't that be the African jungle? And no, they're Vancouver pine trees. Pay no attention to it. And you can see their breath in the flat.
Yeah,
it's like, okay.
You can.
I think they actually had a line in there that's saying, oh, the Africa of this earth is much colder than it's so.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the forest of Vancouver.
That's
where
hilarious.
It always is. As seen in Battlestar Galactica,
warming,
Caprica,
you know.
Arrow, Flash, every other show that's ever been.
So good.
So yeah, so those were the two main threads. I thought that it was obvious which was supposed to be the dramatic storyline, which was supposed to be the
more funny, lighter one.
The comedic effect storyline. The Rip stuff definitely worked better for me, though. Seeing them go up against, you know, dream versions of, not dream, you know what I mean, like mental versions of themselves in his mind. You see like that weird dark firestorm with like black fire as opposed to regular fire.
Yep.
Which didn't quite look as convincing as the regular fire effect.
Yeah, that
like
was a little weird,
out.
But I think they had to both make him seem a little bit more evil, but also there are basic effects that you can do that take a long
Well, I think
time
all they did was literally just go into the computer and any white values in Firestorm's normal fire effect, they just set to black.
Just,
I think that's
yeah.
probably all they did. I like that we have Rip back. I thought that the stuff with him learning that he has power over his own mind, I mean, we've seen that a million times before in other stories, but that stuff worked well enough for me. What do you think of the aspect of having Gideon, like having Amy Pemberton actually appear in the flesh as Gideon, as opposed to just providing the voice and it being a beautiful woman that, like the whole, it's like the Doctor and the TARDIS, I guess, where Doctor Who fans will tell you that the TARDIS is...
I think that's what they were trying to go for,
It's like
the
Doctor's wife. It's like the Neil Gaiman episode of Doctor Who, where the TARDIS is the Doctor's one true love.
Right.
In a way, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of the same, but I don't know.
I liked that storyline, but...
I think they gilded the lily a bit with the kiss. I could have done without the kiss.
I think I could have done without that too.
But the idea of the fact that Rip, and I also feel like unlike the Doctor and the TARDIS, You've never really, I mean, a little bit, especially in the season premiere where he sacrificed himself and he said goodbye to Gideon and all that stuff. Like, aside from one or two moments, I've never really gotten the sense that he has this deep emotional bond with his ship either. You know, there's been a couple of times.
There have been a couple of times. I could buy the bond to his ship.
Yeah,
ship has been his companion for years and years and years. That ship was with him through time when he was trying to save his family before he recruited the first legend at all.
To me, I didn't buy it as much as I would say the Doctor in the TARDIS or Kirk in the Enterprise or something like that. To me, it's like this is his home.
Okay.
It's a thing that's important to him, but the idea that he has this deep emotional, almost romantic connection to it, to me, like, I don't know. The Doctor is such a bizarre character to begin with that the idea that he could actually have romantic feelings towards his conveyance,
yes,
I buy, because he's alien. His thought processes work differently.
But he also knows there's some sort of an entity running the ship as well.
Well, like, the Doctor does, yes.
Right, the Doctor.
That's not the case here.
About.
He's literally just a computer.
I know.
So that's why I didn't... many reasons why it didn't work as well for me here as it would, say, in Doctor Who.
Yeah, agreed.
I could have done without that. And then later at the end, he sees her again. I mean, that kind of makes sense because she was in his mind to begin with. And so, you know, it makes sense that maybe he would see her in the real world. Like, he imagines that she's there or hearing it. Or no, it wasn't that he saw her.
He talked to her.
No, it wasn't that he saw her. It was that she, real Gideon, seemed like she knew what had happened in his mind.
Yeah.
Which to me makes no sense.
Right.
Because it's not, his mind wasn't interfaced with the computer. His mind was, quote unquote, interfaced with Sarah and Jax.
No, well, that was through the computer. They had the capability on the ship that Rip never availed himself
that's
of because
true.
He didn't believe in that form
I guess,
of
I guess
invasion
that's true.
And
I guess
rehabilitation.
That makes sense.
So that part does make sense.
I guess that makes sense. I don't know. That the way that whole thing resolved,
I wasn't
as crazy about.
It was kind of weird. It was like, little bit weird.
The other problem I had is that I feel like I'm complaining. I mean, I really did enjoy all three of these episodes.
We're just poking holes at all the things.
There were a few things that bothered me. And the other thing is that I feel like we commented
on this.
We
really like this show. Now, here's what's wrong with it.
We commented on this a couple of weeks ago in the Civil War episode where a bunch of our characters were fighting for their lives. And meanwhile, Nate and Amaya are getting it on in that tent.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Seemingly oblivious to the fact that their friends could be dying right now. Similarly, in this episode, they send Ray out to do an incredibly dangerous, like, reconnaissance/scouting mission.
Yeah.
And they're like, they don't offer to go with him.
No.
They don't say, well, let's fortify our position. Let's maybe search our surroundings to make sure there aren't any other threats. They just immediately start talking about their relationship. And Amaya is just like constantly trying to kiss Nate because she's had this epiphany, which I buy her epiphany from a character perspective because Stargirl told her that, you know, they need to make their peace with their current situations and follow their hearts and not always hold on to being members of the Justice Society and doing things the 1940s way. It was set up by the last episode. To me, it seemed sudden that she had had this. Apparently, it had affected her on a way that we didn't really see until she said it in this episode. But
this show does that a lot. It's kind of like it'll give you the one line that sort of sums up a massive process of enlightenment.
Yeah,
in
things
some point.
Are things are set up, but we don't see the characters go through the emotional journey.
It feels
that
like
you
a
feel
one
like
sentence summary instead of like
everything
an arc.
Everything. If you were to read it on a page,
sure.
Stargirl tells Amaya that she needs to follow her heart and find her happiness where she can find it because everything is fleeting and the Justice Society is gone. And then in the next episode, we have Amaya tell Nate that and realize that she wants a relationship with him for those reasons. That all works on the page.
Sure.
But we're seeing human actors play out these scenes and we need to be brought on the journey with them more than just a plot synopsis would allow. And so when we don't see these people go through the intervening emotional states, we feel like it comes out of nowhere, even though on paper it was set up.
Yes,
I feel like
that's
something that this
it's
show
like
does
a bullet point
more than the other
instead
shows.
Instead of a fully written prose.
But be that as it may, my original point was, again, they start talking about their relationship and starting a relationship while another member of their party, I think it's Ray again, because it was Ray that was in danger last time too, right?
Yep.
He's out there. He could have been
eaten
by
a
dinosaur
zombie,
for all they know.
That was the zombie thing, so everybody
maybe
was
he's being eaten by a dinosaur for all they know. They literally already know that they're being tracked by a massive dinosaur that has a mat on for Ray. That is literally all they know
that's
about this
setup.
Period in history.
Yep.
And they start talking about the relationship. So that bothered me a little bit too, but because that whole storyline was played more for laughs, it didn't bother me as much. And then we get the cool moment where Amaya is able to commune with the dinosaur and
that was cool.
Talk it down. That was cool. So I liked that we have Rip back. To me, it seemed, I don't know. they've been setting it up for a long time that Rip is evil and we need to bring him back to the good side. But when it actually worked...
Yes.
I to me, it's like, really? Like, he's... I don't know. Some part of me is wondering if there's another shoe that's going to drop. Because after 15 episodes or however many it's been of him being either missing or evil, they get him back on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And then like one episode later, he's good again. And to me, I would have expected, you know, the season to play out from Rip's perspective in three acts. Like act one, he's missing for like the first third of the season, right?
Yep.
Act two, they find him, but he's evil. And then in act three, the final third of the season, he's redeemed, he reclaims his identity, and then by the end of the season, he's the Rip Hunter we know and love. So it surprised me that happened like six episodes before the end of the season,
mm-hmm.
that he seemingly overcame his demons yep. and the Legion's mental conditioning in the span of one episode,
yep.
after all this buildup.
Yeah.
That surprised me a little. I mean, again, do you really want to drag it out for too long? Maybe
exactly.
not.
Exactly. I mean, they spent the entire episode with this as the main point of overcoming the demons that the Legion of Doom had put him into, like the shackles, the mental shackles that they trapped him into somehow. It was short, but it did make sense. And I feel like what you just said, like how much can you belabor the point? Like, what are they going to do? Like a four-week arc where we get ripped back in this mental journey? Or do we just, you know, hook him up to some computers and use some very seldom used technology to help?
I am looking forward to, though, it seems like they're setting up at the end of the episode, they're going to have to go back and thwart the Legion of Doom in the time of the space race, because we see Thon is already there, right?
Okay, yeah.
You remember the scene
yes,
where he
I
was
do.
Like a doctor giving
right,
a physical
in 1970,
to an astronaut?
Yeah. Which, by the way, did you look up that astronaut's
no,
name?
No, did you?
No.
Okay, well, that's fine. He might just be a fictional character that's going to have
he
a bigger
could.
Role in the next episode, for all we know. It's not like it's not Gus
he
Grissom
had a giant...
or Buzz Aldrin or Neil
right.
Armstrong or
exactly.
something. I am looking forward. The reason why I bring that up is I am looking forward to presumably in the next episode, the show going back to our guys showing up in a different period of history and having to thwart the Legion of Doom.
Yep.
Because that's to me, like the Thon, Merlin, Dark trio
there you go.
Is so much fun on screen. Bickering at each other and trying, and our guys trying to thwart them and, you know, stumbling over themselves while doing so. That's the stuff that I've enjoyed the most this season.
Yep. Probably
maybe my favorite episode of the season was the one that focused more on the Legion
of
Doom.
On the three of them,
and them
yes.
trying to, you know, string Rip along and get him to, right?
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed that. So to me, they've got a stronger threat this season, right,
yes.
than they did last season. And the episodes that are more about the team, talking about their feelings and trying to do other stuff amongst themselves, like the internal dynamics of the team, are less interesting to me than the Legends versus the Legion of Doom stuff.
Yeah, to me. I agree.
So I'm looking forward to them getting back to that.
I agree.
I think the internal stuff can be done well. I'm also waiting to see how Captain Cold figures into all this, because all the stuff going into this season trumpeted Captain Cold is the fourth member of the Legion of Doom. But so far, all we've gotten is that one brief scene where Heatwave was seeing him. And we talked about, was that all in his mind? Or was that the Legion messing with him somehow?
Like, right.
And which version of Captain Cold is going to join the Legion? Will it be past Snart, who was still evil, or present Snart, who went out like a hero? But we're like three quarters of the way through the season, and he
yep.
hasn't shown up on the team yet.
Yep.
So I'm a little bit surprised by that, too. I was looking forward to seeing that dynamic play out.
Yep.
So maybe we'll see that sooner rather than later. But I think, I mean, when they signed Wentworth Miller to that CW contract where he could appear as a guest star in any of the shows, I mean, they've gotten their money's worth out of that because he's appeared on Legends a couple of times and Flash a couple of times.
Yep.
But I kind of feel like I was expecting more, you know? Like, they signed John Barrowman to the same deal, and he's been in like 10 episodes of Legends of Tomorrow. And he's
right.
going to be in the Flash musical episode. And he's going to be in, you know?
Yes.
So they've gotten their money's worth out of that, too. I feel like they haven't really used... But then again, they signed Katie Cassidy to the same deal, and she just appeared in two episodes of Arrow, right? The 100th, and then the one as Black Siren.
Right, exactly.
So I guess that's why they do it, so they can have them at their disposal to deploy however they want. But if they knew they
yeah.
were going to use him in 10 episodes, they would just have made him a regular, maybe. So
maybe.
Or kept him as a regular.
Right.
So we'll see.
But they didn't know. But it's nice that they allowed for that flexibility so that the stories could be as great as they can be without them having to worry about contractual obligation. and prioritize that over the quality of the stories that they tell. So I'm glad they pulled that move.
So that's it for our shows.
We hope that our new listeners really enjoyed it. We hope that our present listeners also enjoyed it. And we hope that you find us on the internets. And here's how you can do that. On Twitter, we are at Smarts Podcast. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/smartspodcast. Our website that houses all of our things is www.smartspodcast.com. And what am I forgetting?
There's always a quattro. That's it, unless you want to plug the YouTube channel again.
There's a YouTube channel now.
Twitter, Facebook, website.
Twitter, Facebook, website, yes. And YouTube. So, yeah, we have a new YouTube channel. We won't be slamming it with videos, but it's still got our few little offerings. So far, just one video. But, you know, you never know. So, you can find us through all those channels, and we hope you enjoy. Now, Trevor does a funny sound at the end of every episode.
It's your turn. Do a PAX-related sound. Or a Switch-related sound.
Well, how about... Okay, for Switch, I've got... And for PAX, I've got Green Flame!